Coming up on Philosophy Talk...
You know how many people one get in this country?
Immigration and multiculturalism.
Vietnamese, Koreans, Salvadorians, those Iranians, Mexicans, Bolivians, your Greeks, your Turkish...
Have mercy. So many people...
I have mercy, but I can't carry the work home. I just like a TV set. Turn me on at 8, turn me off at 4.
Should ethnic or cultural identity ever be considered in a country's immigration policy?
Not in a multicultural society.
So we should welcome immigrants who reject the society's values?
Let's practice our English.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Let us practice. Kiss me beautiful.
Beautiful?
Beautiful. I love you.
Doesn't the first world's contribution to climate change give it an obligation to welcome climate refugees?
Our guest is Sarah Song from the UC Berkeley Law School.
Immigration and multiculturalism.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help again, now more than ever.
So here's what to do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. Should immigrants assimilate into their new society?
Or should society adapt to make room for different cultures?
Aren't there some foreign customs locals should never accept?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about immigration and multiculturalism.
Multiculturalism, Josh. Such a buzzword these days. It's the idea that each culture within a society should maintain its own identity rather than a assimilating to the dominant one, sort of like, a salad bar rather than the good old-fashioned melting pot.
Yeah, that's right. And the salad is delicious. I mean, I benefit from myself. I'm an immigrant here, but, you know, I get to hang on to some of my Britishness. I get to watch real football, not that fake kind that you guys enjoy. I get to drink single malt scotch and my Earl Grey tea.
Josh. I love you, dude, but you're kidding yourself. You're the most assimilated Brit I know. I mean, your accent, it's almost totally American, dude. You talk loudly in restaurants even when you're abroad, just like an ugly American. I bet. Come on, tell me the truth. When you go back to England, people look at you and say, Josh, you've become so Yankified. What happened?
Guilty as charged.
Well, don't feel bad. That's a good thing. I mean, think about it. People from all over the world come here. They join together in a common national vision, man, a shared project. We set aside what separates us, and we focused on what brings us together. That's what got us to the moon, Josh, that can-do American spirit.
Yeah, but, you know, assimilation also comes at a real cost, Ken. You know, I mean, think about a Muslim person who moves to a majority Christian country. That person could assimilate, but they'd have to give up their religion, and that seems like a pretty high price to pay.
I'm not telling people they have to give up their religion. They can live out their separate identities in the private sphere. That's fine with me. But when it comes to the public sphere, where we all get together to deliberate about how to solve our collective problems, well, that's precisely when we need to focus on our shared humanity and check our identities at the door of the public square, dude.
I don't agree. Look, I think it's beneficial, not just for individuals, but also for society, if you have people living out their differences in public. I mean, just think about food. Are you telling me you want people to cook their delicious curries and pastas and enchiladas in secret and not let anybody else have a taste?
Yeah, Josh, look. That's a terrible metaphor. I'm not talking about food. Food never did anyone any harm. That's not the issue.
I guess you never have British food.
And I don't intend to. The problem with multiculturalism is that some cultures, you know, they include elements of some pretty ugly things. Misogyny, homophobia, racism. Wouldn't you rather people shed those attitudes when they come to America?
Oh, right. Like people born in America never have any of those attitudes?
Okay, come on. I grant you. Americans, our fellow Americans can be, you know, a little bigoted at times, a little racist, a little xenophobic, but all that, that doesn't deserve a place in our liberal democracy. Look, whether or not we always live up to them, our norms and institutions, they're all about fairness. They're about equal treatment. So what do you propose instead, Mr. Multiculturalism, when people come in with very different norms, very different laws and customs? What do you propose?
Laws? You're talking about Sharia law or something?
Well, yeah. I mean, are you saying we should let immigrants who endorse Sharia, for example, just to take an instance, I mean, maybe rewrite the civil code or live by their own laws in their own little communities? Is that what you're proposing?
I'm not saying that. I'm not talking about people rewriting the law. I'm just saying let them do their own thing. I mean, it's just like John Stuart Mill said, as long as what they're doing isn't harming anybody, we should accept it. We should even welcome it.
No, but it is doing harm. It's undermining national solidarity. You can't have solidarity if every little subcommunity has its own practices, its own norms, its own language. You just can't, Josh.
Mais non, monsieur. Tout le monde devrait parler français.
Wait. That was French, right?
Uh-huh.
What are you telling me? Is suddenly you're okay with everyone speaking the same language? What, as long as it's French?
Oui, pourquoi pas?
You're kidding. You're kidding. You're like those French Canadians who want to outlaw English.
Would that really be so horrible?
No, you're not serious. At least I hope not. But on that note, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out how Quebec has tried to preserve its identity as a French-speaking region, often at the expense of its own multicultural heritage. She files this report.
As a young child, the Czech language was all Julie Sedeví knew. Then her family moved from what was then Czechoslovakia through Austria, Italy, and finally East Montreal. She learned French from kids in the neighborhood, but started school in English.
It was implicitly clear to me, even as a child, that English was the most prestigious language to speak, that it was the language in which things got done, the language of serious people, the language of education.
This was in the 1970s, when almost all immigrants in Quebec chose to have their kids educated in English, like Sedeví's parents did. But the French speakers of Quebec felt their culture and language threatened by the pull of English in multicultural Canada. So Quebec officials took action.
Quebec put in place a set of language laws that would prohibit immigrants like my family from educating their children in English. After a certain time, they were only allowed to send their kids to school in French.
The government's language laws also required all business signs and brochures to be in French, even wine lists and menus. These rules were enforced by Quebec's language enforcement agency, nicknamed the Language Police. This enraged some of Quebec's minority Anglophones and frustrated Sedeví. Even as a kid, she saw how English could be used like a currency to win acceptance and approval.
Certain extended family members had their choice of language curtailed by those language laws. I think it sort of shifted the assumptions about which language was most useful and most valuable. Now all of a sudden you became very handicapped. If you didn't speak French, it became harder to find a job.
But now she understands why the government did this. Sedeví is a writer and a cognitive scientist who specializes in languages. When her dad died, she realized how much she missed her native Czech tongue.
I'm now more aware of the fact that a dominant language like English really has the potential to steamroll over minority languages unless something is done to bolster the status of some of those weaker or smaller languages.
The language laws did help preserve French in Quebec, and younger generations aren't as concerned that the language will die out now.
I've discovered a changed landscape.
Dan Bilevsky also grew up in Montreal. He lived abroad for 28 years, but recently returned as a New York Times correspondent.
The cultural wars of the past have largely dissipated, and the younger generation is much more interested in being the next Quebecois Bill Gates than in revisiting the atavistic linguistic arguments of the past.
In contemporary Quebec hip-hop, you hear a lot of language mixing. Take the francophone rap group Dead Obies. We just getting started, bit captivated. Looking at me now, thinking now they made it. Step up is about being felt famous. Command more shit, what the hell my name is got done. Or the comedian Sugar Sam, who jokes in both French and English.
All right, welcome to the illegal English edition. Okay, fait qu'on va faire ça en français, là.
In his routines, he often jokes about language.
You have a French accent, no? You're practicing your French accent? While speaking English, you don't need to do that, man.
But you can still find some language purists in Quebec. Sugar Sam's critics have called him a francophobe federalist bully and a traitor. Quebec legislators recently told shopkeepers to stop saying
bonjour, hi.
An Italian restaurant in Montreal faced the ire of the language police for saying
polpette
instead of
boulette de viande
and
pasta
instead of
pat.
The language laws in Quebec are always bubbling underneath the surface, and every so often they wheel their heads.
Some efforts to preserve secular French culture take more extreme forms. A little over a decade ago, the rural Quebec village of Aéroville introduced a code of conduct for immigrants. The code explained that people in the village enjoyed dancing, music, and Christmas trees. But some rules could also be seen as extremely Islamophobic, like warnings against stoning women in public and burning them alive. Belevsky visited that village for a New York Times piece last year.
Really, many people who I spoke to were quite unrepentant about this code of conduct, thought it was a good thing, and thought that immigrants who come to Quebec really do need to assimilate and integrate to local norms.
When Belevsky thinks of lingering cultural battles over Quebec's identity, he's reminded of two sculptures near the old port of Montreal. One is of a French woman wearing a Chanel suit and clasping a poodle. On the other side, an English man holds a pug.
Their dogs, the poodle and the pug, are staring longingly at each other.
Meanwhile, the two statues, one French, one English, look away. Belevsky says these statues symbolize Quebec's two enduring solitudes. For what it's worth, these statues are also known as the two snobs. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that battlefield report from the Quebecois language wars, Holly. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy, and today we're thinking about immigration and multiculturalism.
We're joined now by Sarah Song, professor of law and political science at the University of California at Berkeley and author of Immigration and Democracy. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sarah, I think originally you're from Korea and your family moved to the United States when you were just a kid, right? Is that what got you interested in these questions?
Absolutely. I think my experience as an immigrant has shaped my interest in immigration. I remember being 6 years old and immigrating from South Korea to Raytown, Missouri, and my first day of school in first grade, not speaking any English, and with the incredible support of my teachers and my classmates, I was able to quickly learn the language. But it left a vivid impression on me that it's not just the effort or the attitudes that the immigrants themselves have, but the context and the reception and the support that they receive from the host society that makes a difference.
Yeah, so true. That makes me think and hope that you were on my side when Ken and I were disagreeing earlier. You know, I was suggesting that multiculturalism is a good thing, both for individuals and society. Ken was worrying that it reduces solidarity and a sense of common purpose. So where do you stand on this kind of question?
Yeah, so Josh, I think I'm mostly sympathetic to your position.
Mostly.
Let's hear about the
except that.
Yeah, right. So I do think that immigrants should be expected to adapt to the basic norms and basic laws of the societies to which they have migrated. But I also think that they should be able to maintain their distinctive identities and practices so long as they don't cause harm to others. And so when Ken was talking about misogyny and homophobia and racism, of course, there should be limits, just as there are limits for people who are born and raised in the U.S. who are American citizens. But I think there's a lot of room for toleration and accommodation of distinctive cultural practices beyond just what we eat.
I want to believe all that. I really do want to believe all that. But, you know, societies around the world, I mean, that sounds easy, right? Societies around the world are being torn apart over these immigrants. I mean, you know, these Europeans used to think they were so superior to the United States. And I used to think, well, just wait until you have to deal with a flood of immigrants that you're not sure about welcoming. Given what you say, it sounds like an easy solution. Why is it so hard? Why is it ripping nations apart?
Well, I think because identity matters so much to people. And maybe with the migration crisis in Europe, a really important issue is that, for example, Germans in Germany feel a sense of the Germanness is under threat, right? And I think what we need to do is, instead of giving in to xenophobia and nativism, we should think about, well, maybe we can have a more inclusive conception of what it means to be German or what it means
right.
to be
American. That's what I was going to say, because isn't this whole notion of Germanness somewhat illusory? I mean, not completely illusory, but don't we tend to reify what a nation is? It's one thing. Everyone's always done the same thing and thought the same way.
Tell that to those Quebecois in Holly's report. I mean, there's something real that they felt. Right now, they're a minority within a nation, but they're a majority within Quebec, and they want it to preserve their
I mean, I think it's
French
okay
Canadian.
If it's a language. Yeah, if you speak a language, you speak a language. But the idea that, you know, there's a thing called German culture that's always been the same since the Middle Ages or something like that, and everyone's always had it and felt it in Germany, is this really true?
What do you think, Sarah?
Well, look, so culture is constructed, and we can reconstruct it and reimagine it, right? And absolutely, identity is felt as a real and important thing to the Quebecois. I think, actually, Quebec and in the broader context of Canada is a really good example of, right, so the Canadian government defers to the importance of preserving the French language in the context of Quebec, but also recognizing there's an Anglophone minority. And so we need to kind of, it's a tricky road, but it's this middle ground.
Yeah, it's very tricky. Canada's very tricky, very different from the U.S., but you will talk more about this. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about immigration and multiculturalism with Sarah Song from the UC Berkeley School of Law.
Did you come from another country, as I did? Have you assimilated or have you maintained your distinctive cultural traditions? Should new arrivals adjust to local norms or should we adjust to them?
Separation, assimilation, and integration, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Because you know it's all you got. No matter the consequences, all the fear that grips your senses. You have got to hold on to your dream. Yeah.
Immigrants dreaming of a new culture, natives holding on to the old. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about immigration and multiculturalism. Our guest is Sarah Song from the UC Berkeley School of Law, author of Immigration and Democracy.
So, Sarah, I want to look at this from two perspectives, the immigrant's perspective and the nativist perspective. But start with the immigrant. I'm coming to a new country. I got my thick identity and my culture, but how much should I reasonably expect that I have to adapt to the dominant culture, and how much can I demand that it bend to my needs and desires and identity, and where does that come from?
So I think that immigrants, as I said earlier, should be expected to adapt to the basic norms and abide by the basic laws of the society. At the same time, I think they should be given lots of room to practice, engage in their own cultural practices.
But I want to hear the voice of the immigrant speaking to the dominant culture and giving the dominant culture an argument that you owe it to me to let me do X, Y, and Z. Right. And what's the argument that the immigrant can make? What's the set of consideration that the immigrant can make to the dominant culture to say, this is what you owe me?
Great. I think it's an argument from equality. I think it says you may not experience it as cultural, but the dominant culture gets to enjoy its norms, its own practices are already embodied in the law, already embodied in our social structures. Consider religious holidays or the days of rest, right? Sunday. Right. Where do we get that from if we take a historical view? But what if your day of rest is Saturday, right, as it is for Seventh-day Adventists or other religious minorities? And you say, well, can I have some accommodation here? So similarly, when a migrant comes and says, I can't speak English, not yet anyway, what about multilingual ballots? So I can exercise my right to vote, right? Or what about some support for English as a second language learners in schools? Bilingual education? So these
one,
are sort of—
One thing quickly. Yeah. Suppose I said, as the dominant culture, the native, I said, well, wait a minute, dude. or gal or whoever. If you need all that, why are you coming here? I didn't invite you here. You asked to come here, and I don't have multilingual ballots. Why are you telling me that I owe you a multilingual ballot? Why don't you stay where you are if you want a multilingual ballot?
So I think, good, we need to think about why do migrants come? Why are they admitted? Right. And so it's huge pull factor is labor needs, right? Immigrants are recruited here to meet the labor needs of the United States. I think that there's a debate to be had, and we're having that debate about what is it reasonable for immigrants to ask for when they come. I think it's a raw deal if they say, okay, if the immigrant says, let me in, and then I'll do whatever you say. Yeah, you can treat me in any way you wish,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
I think in a liberal democratic society such as ours, our aspiration should be to treat immigrants in a fair way.
I agree. I mean, so I think absolutely the newcomers have a perfect right to say, you owe us fair treatment. I would add, and I want to see what you think about this, Sarah, that, you know, it would be within the right of an immigrant to say, look at what your country has become because of generations of immigrants coming to this country. Look, I mean, so something like half of the Nobel Prize winners in the United States over the past couple of years were immigrants or people from families who had fairly recently immigrated to the States. I also think about the British novel, you know, Zadie Smith, Kazuo Ishiguro, Salman Rushdie. Like, where would the British novel be right now if it weren't for waves of immigration? Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that? I mean, I feel like there's a real argument to be made about cultural renewal. There's something maybe intangible. There's something really important that immigration brings.
Absolutely. I think pointing to the arts and to literature is a really good example, as well as food.
Yeah, food, I feel like we all agree.
Right. Of all the ways in which immigration has benefits the receiving societies in really rich ways.
I get all that. I think those are powerful considerations that you both adduce, but I'm still going to, I don't really want to speak for the xenophobe. This is a little uncomfortable, but I think the argument has to be put out there.
I take you to be speaking more from the solidarity.
Yeah, it is, but it's easy to confuse it. Because I think if you accept a conditional, if I invite you, then I have to invite you in terms of fair participation, right? That seems right. And if I invite you, and I have to think about my reasons for inviting you, and I can't invite you to just be a second-class citizen,
yeah,
right? That seems right. Okay, but now the further question, Josh was kind of getting at this, is why should I invite you? If I invite you because I have labor needs, okay, fine, I invite you because I have labor needs. Of course, I could do this, what the Germans used to do. I know they still do this with the Turks. It's like really hard for a Turk to become a citizen of Germany, but they can be a guest worker.
Right.
I don't know if they've kept that up, but I mean, I could do something like that. Yeah, you know, I'm not really inviting you for full participation because I want to protect my culture, right? And I know that I'd have to, if I invite you to engage in full participation, I have to give in, but I so care about my culture that you can be a guest worker. I mean, why should I invite the immigrant who will culturally new and I mean all that stuff?
Great. So I should just say as a quick note, in Germany in 2000, they changed their citizenship laws, I think, for the better, where...
Well, it was pretty ugly.
Right. So you had second, third generation descendants of Turks who knew no other culture or no other society than Germany, not able to become German citizens. But now they have been able to become German citizens. And I think that that's right. So, yeah, this is a morally vexing area, the kind of how should we think about guest worker programs? And I talk about that in my book. But I think for now, it's important to stress that it depends. Are we admitting you for permanent residence? And is the expectation that you will become full members? And I think that temporary worker programs are a special category. But even there, I think for the duration, if you're doing the work that you're supposed to be doing, why shouldn't you be able to pursue your cultural practices so long as you're not causing harm to others?
I totally agree about that. But I'm just wondering, to the person who wants to preserve this kind of solidarity and national solidarity, I mean, you might think, well, I'll invite guests workers because I'm not inviting them to be permanent members, and so the terms of equal participation in my social life are more constrained. And if I'm thinking to, I mean, Japan, I don't know what Japan thinks about this, but it seems so much hostile to most to America and even Western European democracies to immigration, and I'm not quite sure why they are.
Great. So Japan is a really interesting case because it is much less multicultural society than the U.S. And so the question there is, can they continue to exclude people on the basis of their cultural identities? Here's the thing about Japan, though, that population is aging, the birth rate is low, and they have huge labor needs that they're going to have to meet. And so they're probably going to have to open up to immigration. And the question there is, do they try to select people who are going to be more culturally similar, or are they just going to try to think about who's going to meet those labor needs regardless of cultural identity? And I do think they should have the discretion to think about closeness to their culture in selecting whom they admit. But once they admit them, right, they should treat them in fair ways.
I agree. But let's back up to the question of these criteria that they have. I mean, here I have a kind of perplexity about my own intuitions about whether immigration policies should ever factor in national or ethnic identities. Because when I think about Native American communities, those communities get to decide on membership. That seems exactly as it should be to me. Japan, not sure what I think, but I think maybe that's okay if they decide, look, we want to preserve our culture. But when I think of Britain, my home country, and Britain saying, we don't want anyone of a different culture, I think, no way. So what's the difference? Can you help me resolve the distinctions there?
Yes, we need to think. So those are really good examples. I think Britain is already a multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural society.
Multinational, too.
And multinational, right. And so to say, I think it would be insulting and a denial of the equal respect of racial and ethnic minorities that are British.
And in a way, the very identity of a country like Britain is multiplicity.
That's right. And so it sort of goes against that ideal, that multicultural ideal, to then say we're not going to we're going to exclude people from the Caribbean, right? Yeah. Or from Nigeria.
That's the price of being conquerors, you know. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about multiculturalism and immigration with Sarah Song from University of California at Berkeley. We'd love to have your comments or question. And Howard from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Howard, what's your comment? Your question.
I would just like to cast this in maybe what I think of as a deeper kind of moral level, which is about the rules of hospitality. There are responsibilities of the host and responsibilities of the guest that I think are primal undergirding for civilization to begin with. And I think of the old story about, you know, the gods dressing up as wayfarers who show up at the door of a hut where an old couple who are impoverished give them their dinner and their bed and go to sleep hungry on the floor. And in the morning, the gods reveal themselves and grant them their fondest wish, which is to die at the same time together. And there are so many levels to that that it seems to me if we start from a place of really deep humanity like that, and then address the questions, we might come to a different sort of solution.
Thanks for the comment, Howard. Sarah, you got a reaction to that?
Yeah, so I think there is a rich tradition of thinking about hospitality and the kind of obligations of hospitality in the history of moral and political philosophy. And I think you're right. So it kind of speaks to basic treatment, kind of equal treatment that human beings are owed in virtue of being human. I think that hospitality only gets us so far, though, because it's talking about temporary migrants, sojourners who are owed, you know, a welcome for a time, but the expectation is they won't be staying. And I feel like our conversation is really focused on those who are going to be permanently staying.
Right. Your guest doesn't have the standing to fundamentally alter your familial relations, right? But I hear you and Josh saying that the immigrant that you welcome, that you invite and accept as a full participant does have standing to say, this culture needs to evolve, and I'm going to be part of the evolving of it. Do I hear that correctly?
That's right, because I think the decision to admit a migrant or a group of migrants is done with the expectation that they will become full members of that society. And so when you make that invitation, that they can make that claim upon you to say, hey, I'm entitled to equal treatment. And sometimes treating me as an equal requires special accommodations, different accommodations.
Vincent from Cupertino's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Vincent.
I wanted to speak about, like, I suppose I see it in both ways. I'm an immigrant in the U.S. I live in California, and I was living for some time in France, where I suppose I saw a lot of immigration going on. And for me, there is absolutely no doubt about the benefits of immigration within the country. I mean, in a way, I see it because I think a lot of really good people, professional, come to the U.S. and work here, and we try to do the best out of the job. And I saw that as well, even with all the problems that they can be. I saw that in France as well. I saw the benefit of having multiple cultural come in my country and be able to get so much from it.
So you see thanks for the comment. I see the benefits of immigration too. I definitely see the benefits of immigration, but I also see the challenge of immigration. I mean, I just think it seems really hard, especially, okay, I want to put another kind of question to you. Some immigrants are from cultures that we find, let's say, deeply problematic. We may think we're right to find them deeply problematic, and we may say, you got to check this at the door and that at the door and this at the door, but you can bring that. Right, you got to check your homophobia at the door, right? You don't believe in gay marriage? Well, we do here. What do we say to those people, right? Because that's like the easy stuff is you got to respect this, that, and the other thing. But the hard stuff is you've got to abandon these things that are deep within your cultural formation. What do we say to those people?
God, I think we have to be careful about, absolutely, we in liberal democratic societies, we want to criticize and condemn homophobia, misogyny, racism. But we have to ask, what does that have to do with culture?
Right.
Is it the bad behavior of individuals, or can we draw a straight line to and say, oh, it's their culture that made them do it? But your question, Ken, reminds me of I think it was the Netherlands that the government produced this video that then it sent to predominantly Muslim countries. That showed this is what Dutch culture consists of. And there were lots of images of LGBT couples, right, on the beach, holding hands, embracing. And the message was, if you cannot accept, right, that this is what Dutch culture is about, you shouldn't come.
Wow.
You shouldn't come.
How was that received?
Mixed, to say the least. But you get I see where your question's coming from. But I think here's what I think was problematic about those videos, which is sort of it already assumes that the cultures or the communities that they're sending these videos to are kind of deeply ingrained in a certain set of beliefs. And I think it's much more, there's more disagreement. And I think cultures are much more multifaceted and polyvocal than that.
It assumes on the other side that the Dutch culture is homogeneous.
Exactly.
Well, but wait a minute, does that make it really complex? Because somebody may claim to be the arbiter of Muslim cultural identity, and we say we don't accept. But if there's disagreement within the Muslim subculture, do we as the dominant have a right to protect the minorities within that minority from the coercion of, you know, the would-be arbiters? And doesn't that make it even more complicated?
Great question. This is something I've thought a lot about and have written about. But so take a concrete example, like the headscarf affair, right, in France. And you have these young Muslim women wanting to wear the headscarf, and the French state saying, no, you can't wear them to school and in the public sphere. And there, I think we have to attend to, there's disagreement in the community about what wearing the veil, what wearing the headscarf means. And I think we have to be careful to rush to judgment that, oh, the veil or the headscarf is a symbol of oppression, right? It's it's contested, and we need to be careful about making that judgment.
Okay, I'm going to ask you. We're going to ask you more about this. This is a great conversation. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about immigration and multiculturalism with Sarah Song from the UC Berkeley School of Law.
In a rapidly changing world, how should countries adjust to the influx of new migrants? Should there be the same borders, tighter borders, no borders at all?
Tearing down walls. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Africano clandestino, marijuana illegal.
Migration, clandestine and otherwise, is remaking the world. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Sarah Song from the UC Berkeley School of Law, and we're thinking about immigration and multiculturalism.
And we've got a caller, Philip, from New Mexico, all the way from New Mexico. You must be listening online, Philip. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Well, thanks for taking my call. My name's actually Philippe, and that's relevant.
Philippe, okay.
I'm born. My mother is a French Jew who survived the Vichy occupation,
wow.
But her father and her brother, who were born in Poland, did not. They were deported, and so I'm sort of right on the front line of some of your conversation. And what's really apposite, I guess, is we've been discussing a French intellectual by the name of Eric Zemmour. I don't know if your guest is familiar with him. He is a French Jew who is very critical of French immigrants, recent French immigrants, and their reluctance to assimilate. And so literally I was talking to my mom 20 minutes ago about Zemmour and the whole issue of what back in the 1960s in this country we called beyond the melting pot.
So, okay, Sarah, you're going to react to that? Thanks for the call, Philip. Thanks for the observation. You can react to that?
Yes. So, I think the integration of immigrants is a two-way street, and it matters very much that the immigrants seek to integrate, but I also think it makes a big difference the kind of reception that the French government or the U.S. government provides to immigrants. And I think it's through policies like some of the multiculturalism policies or accommodation policies that provide a more welcoming environment. And some of it may just seem purely symbolic. And people may dismiss them. And Ken, in your role, you might be dismissing them, saying, "Why is it really that important? Just expect people to assimilate." But I actually think that people's sense of belonging—are they really welcome here?
Yeah.
Makes a difference to their orientation to the
right.
broader society. And if there's xenophobia, if there's pushback, or just the assumption that everybody who's coming these recent days. Refuses to integrate, I think that's a problem.
So one of the things I was taking from this discussion, you talk about policies and all that from the government, but I actually think, it sounds like you think, and I think I really agree, that one of the things that needed is what I call civic conversations about these things. That we have very... One of the things that depresses me to no end about America is the decline of the civic space in which citizens meet each other and face-to-face and engage in civic discourse with one another. We have so few fruitful civic conversations. And it sounds like part of what we need is like, hey, let's talk this through, you know, so that I know what matters to you, you know what matters to me, and it's like a family in therapy. I think the American family needs tons of civic therapy.
I'm all for that. We need more conversations like this, more civic conversations where, and absolutely, Ken, it's not just about the policies or the formal official kind of reception that immigrants are given. It's about an ethos,
right.
our own attitudes in everyday life toward the different people that we encounter.
But even the policies, I mean, France is a great example of this, to get back to the headscarf issue. I mean, France has had a headscarf ban in public schools, and that can lead to a kind of ironic result if you have parents simply saying, all right, I'll pull my kid from public school. We'll educate her somewhere else. That can have the opposite effect to what's intended.
Yeah,
that's right, and I think that's a major downside of the ban, in addition to its failure to kind of show equal respect toward French citizens of all backgrounds. And also, what's the best way to get a teenager to do the very thing that you say the opposite, right? Uh-huh. But to say you can't wear, you can't,
must.
You know, to say right, then
but
it can't.
That's right. Another matter of the absence of civic conversation and just thinking policies are going to do the trick. But we got another caller, Jackson from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jackson. What's your comment or question?
Hi, my comment was more just, I think that there should be more consideration for the Native American perspective on this because, in my opinion anyway, I feel that we pretend that these are our lands to decide on who and who to share them with and how. And really, in my opinion, again, it seems it's not really like France or Japan that was brought up with the host-guest relation. More like pillagers now wanting to respect the newcomers and the newcomers wanting to feel respect,
yeah,
but without there being really respect for the first comers.
Jackson, you're raising a really deep and important point, and we're getting to it at the end, so I'm going to put it to you briefly because it's true. I think there really is a difference between, let's call it, multiculturalism and multinationalism, right? Especially a nation like Josh's nation, born of conquest and the rights of indigenous nationalities and all that stuff. And America has done really, 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 and can I add some really badly in respecting the rights of the indigenous peoples here? Canada has at least better aspirations. I don't know if they're better in actuality, but their aspirations and how to treat the indigenous peoples is much better than America. So what do you think about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so I thank Jackson for the question because I actually think there are implications for a multiculturalism for Native Americans. And the idea there is respecting self-government rights of Native Americans and Native peoples in both in Canada and in the U.S., that they get to determine who comes onto their tribal lands, who can be a member of their tribal communities. But I think the deeper point that Jackson is getting at is the right to control immigration or to set these policies assumes that the people currently residing here have a legitimate right to occupy,
yeah,
and to reside here. And these are really hard, challenging moral questions.
We're going to have you back to talk about that kind of thing. But I want to give you one last task, really briefly. We're going to do something we do on Philosophy Talk from time to time. We're going to make you czar of immigration policy for the entire world. You have plenary powers. Okay, what's the one or maybe two, but very few things that you would do to set this whole thing, this whole mess right?
Wow, I wish I had more time to tell you all my ideas. But if I had to pick one or two, and if I were czar, So in my book, I argue not for open borders or for closed borders, but what I called controlled borders and open doors. And I think that the U.S. can do a much better job. And we've talked a lot about the benefits of immigration to the societies that receive immigrants. And I think we should be much more generous than restrictive in admitting migrants for permanent residence. So President Trump, he wants high-skilled, high-tech workers, and he wants migrants from Scandinavia. He seems to especially like Norway.
And not asshole countries,
yeah,
as
right,
he put it.
Yeah, right. But I actually think that we should open up to immigration. I also think that we have to meet our obligations to take in refugees and other necessitous migrants who have nowhere else to go. And I think wealthy countries like the U.S. are falling incredibly short of the obligation to do their fair share.
Yeah. And what's the best way to make that argument to people who don't believe it yet?
The best way to a humanitarian argument that says, right? And think if you were in their shoes, the world is carved up into states and they have nowhere else to go.
Yeah, this is complicated stuff. We'll have to have you back. But for now, on this multifaceted conversation, Sarah, I have to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest has been Sarah Song, professor of law and political science at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Immigration and Democracy. The conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog.
Now grab your popcorn. It's time to take Philosophy Talk to the movies.
So, Josh, you convinced me that I should watch this Netflix thing, Bandersnatch. Why did you want me to watch this? What do you think this is? So, set it up for us.
Okay.
This streaming entertainment event. I will call it that.
So the basic, this is a feature-length episode of the show Black Mirror. So it's a movie. And it involves a character named Stefan, who's a young man, maybe 17, 18, who's a video game designer. I won't say too much about the plot, but he's spending his time designing a video game.
Back in the day.
Good point. He's, the early 80s, maybe?
80s, yeah, right. Something like that.
But the plot is not the interesting thing.
No.
The interesting thing about this movie is you get to choose your own adventure. The character's designing a choose-your-own-adventure video game.
Based on a choose-your-own-adventure book, right?
That's true. So there's a choose-your-own-adventure novel within the world of the fiction. This character, Stefan, is building a video game. It's going to be a choose-your-own-adventure video game based on that novel. And we're watching a choose-your-own-adventure movie, Bandersnatch. And we actually get to press buttons on our remote to decide what happens in the show.
You've got 10 seconds.
Don't worship him. He's the thief of destiny.
You've read Bandersnatch?
Jeremy F. Davis, visionary.
Which ending did you get when you read it?
All of them.
Excuse me?
A lot of divergent realities in that book. It was ahead of its time, in as much as time exists.
It's really working the experiential side of art, right? Because sometimes you can be in a more or less passive relationship. You know, a work of art can put you in a more or less passive relationship to it.
Yeah.
This one puts us in a really active relationship to it. And so the thinking that we do about freedom isn't just about what happens in the movie. It's not just about the characters and what they do. It's about what we're doing. How much freedom do we have? How much control do we have over what happens?
Yeah, except in some of the stories, something really weird happens, right? You are invited to make a choice that will, how to put this, cause the character Stefan to wonder, in effect, whether he's a brain in a vat, being manipulated by an evil demon, as it were. And you are that evil demon, and you get to talk to him, and he doesn't know. I mean, that's not traditional narrative structure.
No.
In which suddenly the character is talking to the author of his life and interacting with the author. That's not traditional narrative structure.
And isn't that just a thing of absolute beauty, right? That at a certain point, you have the option to say, he's talking to Netflix? You? And it's a fantastic self-reflexive moment.
I don't understand. Oh, I don't understand.
Who are you talking to?
It'll sound crazy.
Well, tell me anyway.
I'm being controlled by someone from the future.
What?
I'm being controlled by someone from the future.
Shall I ring Dr. Haynes?
Yes, please.
I have to say, I think the philosophy in it is a little jumbled and incoherent.
I disagree.
Oh, yeah. Well, we could talk about this for hours. Look, it confuses the issue of freedom versus fatalism with the issue of what's called libertarian freedom versus compatibilism. It just really confused about that.
I disagree. I mean, I think the crucial point is that these moments you're referring to are statements made by characters. So you have characters talking about freedom, and some of them are talking about freedom versus some of them are talking about freedom versus determinism. Some of them are talking about freedom versus fatalism. We're not obliged to take the word of a character.
Well, that's true.
As the word of the writer. I mean, here's the way I see Bandersnatch in a nutshell. The central characters in the movie think that space-time is kind of a they kind of have a branching theory of space-time. So that when you make a decision, you're not actually changing anything. You're just moving on to a different branch. And it follows from that that we don't have free will. And it follows from that...
No, it doesn't.
I know. But the characters think this, right? Or at least one of the characters thinks that. And follows from that that we don't have responsibility. Now, meanwhile, we're watching this movie, clicking away on our remotes. And the clicks that we make determine what happens at the end of this movie. And so the experience for us is an experience of freedom.
Killed my dad.
Right. So are you gonna let me go or are you gonna kill me? I mean, it's your choice. in as much as you have any choice.
If you're watching this film with the expectation of seeing a story that's exciting and brand new and something like that, now that's, of course, you won't get that. But if you're thinking you're going to have an experience you haven't had before, then at least for somebody like me, I mean, it's just extraordinarily exciting. And the playfulness. I mean, every now and again, they'll give you a decision and not allow you to make it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Or they'll give you a choice between two things that turn out to be exactly the same thing.
That's beautiful. This thing about you don't know which choices are consequential and which are not and all this. Right. Look, there's a lot. There's an intellectually ambitious thing.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's artistically ambitious thing. And it's a mashup of things. And it doesn't fit into any neat categories. And if you like that sort of stuff, then you'll love Bandersnatch. And if, you know, you like want your movies traditional with a beginning, middle, and single end, you'll be disoriented a bit, but maybe you're supposed to be disoriented. That's what art sometimes tries to do to you.
There's a cosmic flowchart that dictates where you can and where you can't go. I've given you the knowledge. I've set you free.
We've been talking about Bandersnatch, a feature-length episode of the Netflix series Black Mirror.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.